I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The students at Lincoln Alternative High School in Walla Walla, Washington, come from extremely troubled backgrounds. Close to one in three of the girls at that school have been sexually assaulted. Parents have drug problems. The children physically abused at home. Many fathers are absent. Sometimes there's no food at home. These children's brains are always ready for the next threat and don't know if they'll be encountering a real tiger or a paper tiger. Paper Tiger is the title of James Redford's film, which is being shown at the Milwaukee Film Festival. It's a very careful and moving look at the children and the tender and very caring staff at Lincoln. James writes, produces, and directs for film and for television. Prior to Paper Tigers, he directed Toxic Hot Seat, an HBO documentary film that examines the possible health dangers of chemical flame retardants used in upholstered furniture. Other HBO documentary films include The Big Picture, Rethinking Dyslexia, Man v. Ford, and The Kindness of Strangers. He's the co-founder and chair of the Redford Center, which is a nonprofit organization committed to transforming environmental and social challenges into stories that inspire action and change. James, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Well, I saw this film yesterday and I'm thinking, whew, I'm glad these schools are catching on. What a difference they have made in some of these children's lives, and what an incredibly caring staff.
Yes, it's remarkable, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
Yeah, I think the very first thing out of the bat, if I'm in a state that has a lot of that has a lot of fiscal restraint, and you know perhaps in the past there's been a sense that you know resources haven't been distributed well, and there's pressure, as there is in a lot of states, particularly red states, to reduce expenditures at school. The very first thing I would say is, hey, this isn't about necessarily dumping money at the problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is a mental and a moral, emotional mind shift, and it can really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. The universal thing that affects all the students at Lincoln is that they've experienced so much trauma in their lives. You so movingly portray their family lives and how certain things that have happened to them really change their brains and scar them in ways that just stay with them for so long.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, in a perfect world, you would have reached those children at a far earlier age and help them develop skills so that the stress doesn't have that neurological and biological impact, because you can do things to help children in very tough environments when they're young to sort of offset the potential of that stress, because as you're explaining, it's not just a bad experience that is psychologically shaping. These are literally physiological changes that happen in the brain and the body as a result of the hormonal actions that go along with chronic stress in children.
Mm-hmm. And early in the film, one of the teachers is describing to these students what exactly happens to the brain. Were they hearing it as though they had heard it for the first time?
Yes. In fact, that class is a unit within the science class, and it's taught every year at that particular time. And the kids going through, when they get that unit, that's what they hear. And, you know, it admittedly, you know, Eric Gordon, the wonderful science teacher, is the first to say that it's always a very, very difficult unit, because he feels it's very important as a piece of self-awareness and self-empowerment to understand what's going on. And it does offer some explanation for kids that might even be confused by their own behaviors and their own actions and their own feelings. At the same time, you don't want to just leave it at the sort of what's going on scientifically, because it's pretty bleak, and you don't want the kids to feel like, you know, it's irreparable or that there's nothing that can be done.
Mm-hmm. The school even has an intervention specialist because there are students. Stephen is a good example, who's one of the stars of the film, really, who doesn't show up for school. He's not there, and people don't know where he is, and he's off smoking weed and getting drunk during the day. And they have home visits 2 to 3 days a week to find out where these children are.
Yeah, and, you know, it's literally like, the, you know, Brooke would look at her watch, realize she had a little gap, and she says, okay, I'm going. Who's not in school today? And it's obviously extraordinarily hands-on. And it is a very, very, you know, committed and unique group of teachers. But, you know, as an overall note, I think there are quite a few wonderful teachers like this out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think, you know, it's the blend at the school between both the inspiring teachers that are at that school and, you know, had been at the school for a long time, some of them. But, you know, the appropriate sort of administrative leadership and the framing of what the mission is. And that, of course, leads to Jim Spoiler, the principal.
Mm-hmm. Usually when you think of principals, you think of a disciplinarian, not the case with him.
No, but he would be the first one to tell you that for much of the earlier part of his career, it absolutely was that way. He came up in a pretty traditional environment. He started out in physical education and then went to admin. And, you know, there were plenty of years there. He's the first one to say that, you know, sort of a zero tolerance, get tough was the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he felt over time that he didn't feel like it was necessarily effective. And Lincoln, when he went there, was so out of control that he was literally, you know, just sort of looking for anything, looking for, you know, he was almost at a point of desperation to try and get things turned around at that school. So he was willing to try something because he felt like he had very little to lose.
So was there a course that he went to that enlightened him as to what happens to the brain when it experiences this kind of trauma? Is there something that's established, James?
Yes. You know, the interesting thing for me, I've always been interested in this gap between when something becomes scientifically established and there's the science is there and what I'm talking, you know, published in credible journals and, you know, given the stamp, that being there and how long it takes for it to become adopted into the sort of cultural fabric of how we view things. And this issue about the mind-body connection, you know, those facts have been there for over 20 years. The initial study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study was done in 91, and we just weren't really ready to absorb it. The idea of actually having to, you know, I think this whole business of mind-body connection historically is rooted in a very sort of 70s era post-hippie me generations, navel gazing, you know, hippie crunchy, earthy crunchy. You know what I'm saying? It's like mind body to a lot of people is not that far away from seances, you know?
Right.
And I think this business of understanding, no, this is not about being groovy. This is credible science. Mm-hmm. This is neurological. It's, this is a hormonal structure, neurological structure is being impacted. So a lot of the people that have been spreading awareness about this have been doing this for a long time, and there's just something about the last 5 years where we are now willing to entertain, and I think it fits in a much broader category of things we're willing to entertain that are a result of our deeper understanding of the complexity of the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see this sort of adoption, and you know, I made that film about dyslexia, the same thing. It was the functional MRI, it was the imaging that revealed the inner workings of the brain to show physiologically what's going on. It really helped turn the corner for a lot of people who were trying to advocate for change around, you know, what we understand, how the brain works and whatnot.
Yeah. So understanding how the brain works necessitates what kind of intervention for these young people? Because the school is very, very unusual. And I'm wondering what's needed. What does all the science tell the educators?
Well, some of the things are very practical. Some of them are you know, I think I sort of, it breaks down, and we're talking about the teens, and that is those who have had the impact, did not have intervention, and you're now in trying to help them, you know, sort of come around and figure out a way of seeing things and a way of being that that combats these triggers. And so, you know, that what you would do for younger children, by the way, that's a subject of a follow-up film called Resilience that will be out next year, and maybe we will talk about that. But as far as these kids are concerned, a couple of key things. One is that the trigger, the hair trigger, when you have like chronic doses of stress hormones, like, you know, your adrenal glands are firing and you have a lot of epinephrine and you've got cortisol coursing through your body, and that chronologically is there, you're processing things from the primitive part of your brain, which I think you pronounce it the amygdala, which is deep inside of the brain, and it's a part of the brain that deals with life or death, black and white situations, primitive issues around survival. They don't process a lot of things because of this in the frontal cortex, which is far better at being logical and reasoning and creative. So, you know, that what you see very often in combative behavior is literally a neurological issue. Information is being processed in a different part of the brain. So what does a teacher do in that situation? It's a challenge, because really the best thing to do in these environments where you're in a classroom of kids that have been impacted like this is to not respond, to depersonalize. It's not about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's about them. Mm-hmm. And rather than getting insulted and frustrated and angry, which is hard, admittedly, you take a deep breath and you talk quietly and silently and you break it down carefully. You don't get rid of consequences, you know. If something truly, you know, improper has happened, then in-school suspension is a far better way to go than sending kids out into the street where very often they have absolutely nowhere to go and nothing to eat and you know, are left really to the ravages of street life and homelessness and all the problems that come with that.
Yeah. And the teachers also, so many of them in the film express unconditional love for their students. When they say to them, I love you, I love you. I can't imagine too many teachers saying that. They didn't when I went to school.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most unique thing, if you ask me, what I witnessed at that school, was this mantra of love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it was here in an alternative school in Berkeley, I think I could understand it. But, you know, this is Eastern Washington State. And, they really mean it. And they mean it personally, and they also mean it broadly, that they love these kids. And they love working with the kids. And what I saw very much so is that, you know, the difficulty in educating impacted brains, it doesn't eliminate the qualities that are very often very wonderful and just barely under the surface and hiding behind sort of off-putting appearances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's a powerful thing for educators who are driven to do good by teenagers. You know?
Right. I was going to start with Stephen, but instead let's start with, is it Diana or Diane?
Diana,
whose mom socked her brother and me in the face. She burned his hands on the stove. She got kicked out of the house because she met a guy who was 25 years old. She was much older and probably a druggie of some kind. She's screaming, you need me. You can't kick me out. I've helped raise some of the other children. And yet she says, she's the only thing I have. I wish I could go back and never be born again. But her situation becomes so horrible, she has no place to go.
That's right. Yeah. You know, she, and to counter all that, as I was describing, the bright light that's often just in the surface, the reason I chose Diana to be in the movie is that in spite of all that, she has a lively, effervescent presence.
Mm-hmm.
You like her.
Mm-hmm.
And she I can only imagine that given a reasonably secure environment, she would just be a ray of joy and beaming positivity, because it is in her nature underneath all of that to be that way.
Mm-hmm. And amazingly, one of the teachers who's in, it's an in-house suspension room, takes her in.
Yes, that was a remarkable turn of events. And it's not a common thing at the school. It happens occasionally, and it happens in other schools as well. Certainly the idea was not to suggest that this is, should be part of a teacher's curriculum of what to do at these schools. But I think what it does represent is the world of alternative education and the people that are attracted to work in that and serve kids in that world is really unique, and it's filled with really extraordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And very often people who have had a very hard time themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Shelley, who did take Diana in, was no exception of that rule.
She was in foster care herself, some good, some terrible.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of Stephen, obviously a very bright kid, and Aaron, too, a very talented musician, Stephen was changed substantially by the school, but when it came to and got accepted by colleges due to the help of the staff, this having to make a transition from going through this school where you have this support to entering a real world outside of those walls can lead to meltdowns.
Yes, we all know what the senior slump is.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of kids, graduating school is they might not even be aware of how frightening it is, because it's a major turning point in life, and the sense of maturity and responsibility that's about to sort of run roughshod over them can be daunting in ways that they're not even aware of. And I think that's certainly the case at the school. They can almost set their watches to it, particularly kids where this has been the only stable, positive thing in their lives ever.
Mm-hmm.
And leaving there is a very painful thing. And, they know what the outside world is. They know what their world is like. They know what the world is like outside of Lincoln. They have to live in it every day when they leave.
Mm-hmm.
And very often it's bleak. So, this idea that this change is happening and that I'm going to go somewhere else and that comes at a time. Subconsciously, I think what's going on is that they don't want to leave, and if they fail out, maybe they have to, extend a year, or they continue the relationship with the school because there's problems, and better to have the relationship with the school, even if it's a problem, than have no relationship at all. So, it's very complicated, and you got to see the teachers have to navigate that, and it was harrowing at the time. I mean, I watched as well while both Aaron and Stephen looked like they were heading down the tubes.
Hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. I hope some of you, the film premiered, I think, on Saturday at the Milwaukee Film Festival. It is going to be shown again and is well worth your eyes. It will be shown, it was Friday it premiered, Sunday, October 4th, and Wednesday, October 7th. So you can go to the Milwaukee Film Festival and get a whole rundown of when it's going to be shown. But some of you understand and have worked in settings perhaps similar to what James documented at Lincoln High School. It's an alternative high school in Walla Walla, Washington. The kids there are all labeled. They are nothing but troubled, would be the impression that you have of the school and the students who are there. They're forced to be there. Some considered it the worst school you could ever go to, and for many it turned out to be real lifesavers. These are kids who have experienced great trauma in their lives. Home environments are very unpredictable. As a result, their behaviors are very unpredictable as well. With an incredibly caring staff, many of whom came from similarly traumatic childhoods, these kids are listened to and loved, and many of them actually thrive. So, how do we turn around people who have had those kinds of childhoods? Our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation with the filmmaker, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. James Redford is our guest, and James produces and directs for film and television. And we're talking about his documentary, Paper Tigers. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go to phone calls. James Redford's film is Paper Tiger. It's being shown at the Milwaukee Film Festival, and it centers on the students and the staff at Lincoln Alternative High School in Walla Walla, Washington. We go to your phone calls and to David in Milwaukee first. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for talking. This is a wonderful subject because I kind of lived that. I'm almost 64, and I was in an alternative, actually right in the high school for kids who just couldn't hack spending the whole day in school. I got out of school and worked, and made me help me get through high school. One thing I'd like to comment on is this reminds me a lot of foster kids. You know, they age out of the program, and then they're just kind of in limbo. You know, we need to take better care. Just because you're 18 doesn't mean you have your act together. That's any 18-year-old, you know. But I think we need to do more. You can't just drop them. You know, this school sounds fantastic. You can hear the love. You can feel love, you know, so even these kids just in limbo, I think we got to do something about that.
Thank you for the call, David. James?
Well, you know, I agree, and really, the film represents their journey through high school, and they're poised to move forward, and I think the real challenge for them when they left, the ones that went to college, was that the institutions that they went to had zero capacity to deal with them in the way that Lincoln had. So it was a real adjustment. I mean, Stephen has taken some time off. He finished his first year. He's taken some time off. He's working in Bellingham, Washington. And he's doing well. But, you know, it's a big leap to go to college. And, you know, you have this support, and then you go somewhere that has virtually no awareness of that. It's a transition. Aaron, by the way, he's doing very well. He is taking classes at the Walla Walla Community College. He moved back to work for a Shakespeare company. He's both managing and acting, and he's going to be teaching kids after school at the local regular high school. And Eternity's slowly working her way through high school, college part-time. But it's been hard for all three of them. And, you know, Jim Spoiler, the principal, is no longer the principal at the school. He has moved on to trying to spread this trauma-informed awareness deeper into other branches of the educational system in Walla Walla and beyond. So he's traveling around talking about all this. And one of the things he's really focused on is trying to get colleges to have better transitional programs for those that need them. Hopefully we'll make some headway. Because 18 is not an adult. No. And I can personally attest to that.
Yeah, it sure isn't in this society, is it? It's just people aren't ready. We haven't talked about Eternity, and she's an interesting person in the film as well. She's the child with cerebral palsy, is that right? And
yes.
Said something early on that, you know, my parents wanted to put me up for adoption, but I was the first grandchild, and my grandparents didn't want it. And I was thinking, oh, my gosh, I wonder whoever told you that they wanted to put you up for adoption. She's a lovely young girl, but she was scarred by sexual abuse, too, as so many of the girls are in this film. My goodness, so many of them, James.
Yeah, it's really sad, and the impact. And, you know, and this is, look, I tell things that the film, it's a hopeful environment, and the school does a very good job. It's not going to solve all the problems, and I think the thing that I've had to reckon with that you know, initially was very sort of, you know, disappointing and troubling to me, but I've gotten more philosophical about it, is the fact that both Eternity and Diana, you know, it's been 2.5 years since they graduated from high school. Both of them are currently, well, one of them just had her baby. Diana had a baby.
Oh, she did.
And Eternity is pregnant. Diana, it was an active decision. She was doing very well at cosmetology school, earning a living and going to school. But she really wanted it. She had a boyfriend she loves and wanted a child and did it. Hmm. And, you know, initially I was, you know, I was thinking back on the film, you know, because she mentioned she's so proud of herself or, you know, she's the first one to mm-hmm. not be pregnant by the age of 15 in her family.
Mm-hmm.
And so initially I was, oh, you know, oh. But the truth is that, you know, it is a big step forward to have left high school and be employed and be on your own and you know, have gotten that far rather than going through this at 15. It's a profound step forward. But I do think, and similarly in Eternity's case, what I see, and I saw it many times played out in the school. In fact, one of the big things that the school is pushing for now, which I really encourage, and this is going to, like, you know, kind of blow some people's minds, but they're working to get daycare for the teen mothers
mm-hmm.
at that school.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it is that common. And I've come to see that, you know, it's really about love. And those of us who have children and go through the process of bringing them to adulthood like I have, you know, and any parent knows that, you know, you give more than you receive.
Right.
And that's the great thing about being parents. And, you know, it's just so the idea that you have children to help, you know, address your craving for love is really understandable. But it's also sometimes very hard to deal with the fact that it's not that easy as you go about raising kids. So, you know, I really hope for the best. And everything I see with Diana online and otherwise is that she's taking just excellent care of this child and is super happy about it. And I really wish her the best.
And what about Eternity?
Well, she's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, I'm concerned because she has challenges of her own and a lot to manage. And I just, you know, I hope for the best as she is in school. But I think, you know, once you've been a parent and gone through the journey, you know, it's hard. And I just wish her the best.
Yeah. David, thanks for your call. Jim in Western Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I taught in a program for kids who couldn't be in the regular classroom, 68-69 at the Bryant YES Center, which was dealing with many of the same problems. And it was so stressful that my lead teacher left with a mental breakdown in the middle of the year, so I got hired to fill out the class. But I personally am dyslexic. I'm now 72 years old, and I've worked with kids quite a bit of my life, and you really do get to appreciate what these kids go through.
Mm. Well, yes, and, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that you're dyslexic. May I ask you when you were diagnosed?
Pardon me?
May I ask you when you were diagnosed with dyslexia?
Never been diagnosed, but I knew by fifth grade that there was something real different. I would score very high in the Iowa basic skill tests, but I couldn't spell. I was not at all motivated to do the classroom work. I learned by listening and, you know, regurgitating what I was able to take in. But I still, when I go to sign my name when I'm tired, I'll reverse the first letters of my name.
Well, I'm very familiar with that, not only with my own family situation, but I made a film about it for HBO. And one of the things I, you know, and this relates back to Lincoln, is you look at the profile today, if you come from an affluent family or you're in an environment where there are resources, the challenges of dyslexia, there's a lot of headway being made. And, you know, you can get accommodations, you can get remediation, you can get a diagnosis that enables you to understand that it's not a character flaw or an intelligence flaw. It's a processing of information differently. End of story. And, you know, if you're in an environment where you can have access to that, it's tremendously helpful. However, the majority of kids don't have those sorts of resources. And when you have something like dyslexia and you're in a troubled home environment without a lot of resources, it just adds fuel to the fire because it's just another aggravant. It's another thing that makes you look like something that you're not. It's just another thing that makes you seem difficult, and it can be misunderstood as laziness and apathy. And, you know, it's just a further aggravant. And, you know, very often just gets thrown in the hopper of problematic behavior rather than pulled out and looked at and diagnosed and dealt with. Mm-hmm. It's really unfair.
That's another thing at Lincoln was they had this, and it seemed to be extraordinarily important and helpful, this health service center right on the campus.
Yes, and, you know, that's no easy thing. I mean, that was not something that was mandated by the school district. That was something that was done as a nonprofit and continues to be a nonprofit and, you know, got the permission to do it in conjunction with Lincoln High School. But it's unique. It's hard to raise money for. They get by on a scrappy budget. Every year is a challenge. But obviously the results are extraordinary.
Thank you so much for your call, Jim. Jack in Kenosha, hi.
Hi. Nice to be able to talk to you.
Thank you.
I'm a former college counselor, and I worked with special needs students. But the one comment I wanted to make about all this is sometimes the systems and the supports and the helps that we have are necessary. But the things that wound us are relationships or the lack of them. And the things that heal us are always relationships. You need people who really offer straight-on love and care and respect. And all these other things are supplementary and oftentimes necessary, but you've got to have people there who are willing to stay in relationships with individuals who've been hurt and wounded, and that's eventually which allows them to heal. And if anybody's ever gardened, you may notice, just as an example, you can put four plants down all the same. I've done that. Two of them begin to bloom wonderfully, but it took more fertilizer, more water, and waiting and sunshine to see some of them finally bloom. But if you stay with them, they do. And then I'm just trying to make the point that everybody's different, and you have to care for each one as a person, very much what the Pope's been talking about.
Mm, very well said, Jack. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, that's extraordinarily well put, and I couldn't agree more because, you know, this is proven by research, published research, is that, you know, the biggest difference you can make, if you have a kid who has an ACE, you know, this relates to something called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, where you can actually fill out a questionnaire and review your experiences as a child and sort of rate what your sort of risk factor is. It's not a doomsday sentence. It's literally just helping you understand what your risk factor is. And, you know, the most powerful thing to offset if you've had a high rate of abuse and neglect as a child, the most effective thing is one stable, caring relationship. It doesn't have to be mom or dad. It can literally be anybody, because the power of that consistency that this fellow on the phone is talking about is profound. And the thing about that is, you know, as I said in the earliest part of this call, this is not a matter of having to persuade the legislatures in your community to spend more money. It's about finding and making the job attractive. I mean, yes, in certain things like classroom sizes, infrastructure, things like that have an impact. But this is something that I think, you know, if teachers going through teaching schools and getting their credentials and starting out in their careers, if they were exposed and had a segment, a unit on this very issue, on what stress is, how it affects kids, and how being more staying more connected and hanging in there more is the most powerful thing, it just may help them make better choices as they go about being teachers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jack, so much for your call. Let's go back to Stephen for a moment, who kind of falls off the deep end when he's about to graduate from school. Smart kid. He has been accepted to school. And people are wondering if he'll come back and go ahead with his life and get a more advanced education. I thought he said something interesting. His home life was rough, but when he talked about his school, he said, "These are good people. Why wouldn't I listen to them? They proved they were good people, and why not listen to them?" I like that.
Yeah, you know, I really, Stephen is uniquely intelligent, and, you know, it sort of sits underneath all that other stuff going on, and, you know, he picked up on that. And, you know, he's continued to have good relationships with everybody there. And you know, I think sometimes, you know, I know in my own case, when I've been in situations, even when I started out at the school, it took a lot to sort of just look past some of the indifference or the sort of, you know, the students that have been stressed out and are struggling in that way throw up a lot of defenses, and sometimes the best defense is an offense. And if you put off an air of simmering hostility, indifference, boredom, you know, it's all self-protective. And, you know, to see past that is really hard. And I think, you know, clearly their ability to see that in Stephen was really special. But, you know, in the end, I think my feeling is that, you know, that all that is, instead of sort of reacting to in the typical way, which is to sort of let it be a repellent or a repulsive force against you as a teacher, and you go the other way, you go towards it, I think very often, you know, you'd be surprised to find that there's actually an open and vulnerable person lurking beneath the surface,
mm-hmm.
like Stephen.
Yeah. Were you surprised at one of the student body assemblies, at the announcement that half the student body had a 3.0 GPA?
Yes, I was. And you know, I think, you know, that is... My personal assessment is that I think there are high schools that are academically more challenging than Lincoln, but in the end they can't stack the deck all that far, because every one of those kids has state standards to meet, and you know, can't graduate unless they do, and that bar is being met, and you know that those statistics are real, and it is indeed, you know, that is a grade point average. And it's remarkable, and I think the most important thing is that, you know, that clearly the reason there is that success is that the kids are staying in school. The number one problem with grade point average is simply tardiness and absences.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you create a culture where kids actively want to be, they would rather be in school than not, and your attendance rate is really high, the GPA rate is going to go up as well.
Where did they find that staff? I must say, I was just amazed by how effective these teachers were, how genuine they were, and how completely involved they were in their students' lives. They're quite a group.
Yes, you know, I mean, you know, when I mentioned Jim Sporley to the principal, When he sort of adopted this trauma-informed approach and was thinking about how to best do that, you know, there were any number of vacancies at the school, and I think at the time he had some money in the budget to grow the staff and bring in some more teachers. So a number of the teachers in the film were recruited at that time by Jim to be at that school because he had been in the educational system his whole life, much of it there in Washington. And he had the vast Rolodex, and he could think back on, given this is what I want to do, who do I think are the right teachers that naturally fit this? Because, you know, I mean, it's asking a lot. I don't think it's fair to expect that every student be this passionately engaged with their students. I think you can get a long way in doing good trauma-informed work without the same level of commitment. But there are teachers out there. This is how they want to do their job. And so, you know, you really want to try and find them and let them sing in this environment. And that's, you know, that's what Jim did. He really brought in some stellar teachers.
He sure did. Well, welcome more phone calls. James Redford is our guest this hour. He's the director and writer of the film we're talking about, which it did premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival on Friday, and he was in town to talk about it. It's going to be shown also on Sunday, October 4th, and on Wednesday, October 7th. So go online and you'll be able to find out exactly where it's being shown. It is a documentary that looks at incredible high school in Walla Walla, Washington, Lincoln High School. It's an alternative high school for kids who have suffered really great trauma during their lifetimes, and they act out, and they're sad, and they're depressed, and they're sometimes using drugs, and they have home lives that are, in many cases, pretty miserable. The school is this remarkably supportive place, and it's a look at the students and what they're experiencing and what it is that takes to make their lives different as they carry on. So here's our number. We've heard from some of you who have taught in similar kinds of places, and we'd love to hear from you. Or maybe you were a student who was in a school like that, and it made a difference to you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Documentary filmmaker is with us this hour, James Redford, and we're talking about his film Paper Tigers, which is appearing at the Milwaukee Film Festival. I would imagine that you as a filmmaker were incredibly moved by many of these stories and went to school yourself in some way. You spent a lot of time digging pretty deeply into everybody's lives, James.
Yes, I mean, you know, in some ways it seems a little bit more that, you know, it looks like I did a lot of digging. In reality, I didn't do as much as it looks, and here's why. You know, the teacher, you know, the students, there are a lot of students there, and when you select kids, you know, that's your casting. And, you know, I come from a screenwriting and feature directing world as well, and for me, you know, in documentaries, when you have an overarching story to tell, the characters you use, it is casting. And you are looking at a series of kids, and you want to cover a broad spectrum, and you want, you know, can they fit certain themes? Are there certain issues? So all that said, you know, you pick your kids, and then, but then, you know, they're not learning lines, and they're not rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
they're living their lives. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean they want to give you what you think you want from them. And, you know, halfway through the year, it was a struggle, and I understood it. A lot of them were resistant to doing interviews on camera. They, you know, would set a time, and they wouldn't show up, or, you know, they'd sort of not really say anything, or, you know, and Stephen was an example. He would literally duck into hallways to avoid meeting eyes with me. So, you know, it was not easy going, and I came to the conclusion by winter that it was just simply not going to work unless I figured out some way to make them collaborate and allow them or invite them to collaborate with me by bringing them on as sort of masters of their own story. So
mm-hmm.
We handed out cameras to all of them, and I met with them each one by one and walked them through what I thought were, you know, good parameters, which is just tell your story. And your story is what will, and that's the story I will have. And, you know, if you want to do 2 minutes of footage over the next few months, that's your prerogative. If you want to do more, that's it. But I think I would really appreciate it if you could just sort of, you know, give me what you want to give me. Don't worry about it. And, you know, let's see how it goes. And, you know, all of them got into it, some of them to a great degree.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up with hours of footage. So, and I just felt like at that point in time that, you know, with teenagers, you know, better to sort of give them some ownership over this whole thing. It is asking a lot to invade people's lives, and these are very difficult topics and very sensitive issues. And, you know, I don't like the feeling of digging into wounds or prodding. It's just not necessarily some, you know, every filmmaker has their thing. That's not my thing. So, you know, I really sort of spun the wheel to just see what would come in and what they wanted to do and what they were comfortable with. And, you know, and I think it really helped them get more comfortable. And I think all of them, I know all of them feel that it was a worthwhile thing to do because they felt like if they could be, that if somehow or another what they'd been through and what they were going through could help other people, then why not?
Right. Did they all see it together, James?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've had a lot of high-pressure screenings in my life, but the one where I took the rough cut up to show to those kids was about as, I thought I was, you know, I thought I was going to literally crawl out of my skin and leave the room. So, you know, it was, but it was good. And you know, I think they were all pretty surprised. And you know, I heard some laughing and, you know, and we had a good chat afterwards. Kelsey, the young girl was in the relationship and had some struggles with, you know, sexual assault as a little girl. She, you know, it had been, by the time I showed them the rough cut, it had been a year, so she'd moved on from the relationship depicted in the movie. And I think she felt it was a little cringeworthy to look back because she was evolving and growing so rapidly that it was hard to look back because she felt like it no longer applied. And that business of frozen narratives is tough with young people because very often they grow away from something.
Right.
The story is fixed in time. But she's come to terms with it. She's doing extraordinarily well, by the way.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. Robin in Altoona. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you, Robin?
Wonderful. I wish this movie would come to the Eau Claire area, but Milwaukee's good. At least it's Wisconsin.
Right.
But anyway, I am actually a school board member here in this community, and what he's saying is just so enlightening to hear that on a national level. What I'm thinking is that this is much more common than what the general population knows about, and we kind of get it, you know, in trouble our school systems for, oh, things like, you know, testing. The testing is poor, da-da-da. Well, if you look at the needs of kids and, you know, think of Maslow's and that type of thing, testing or grades are not your most important thing. It's survival. And my real question here is what can we do as a community to help these kids, because we can't send them all to Washington as much as I wish some could go. But do you have any solutions in that realm?
Well, so 2 points. One is that, you know, it is far, I mean, one of the most striking thing about the Adverse Childhood Experiences study is that it took a look at, you know, the health records of 17,000 mostly white, educated, upper-middle-class people living in San Diego. And these stunning statistics such as, you know, 1 in 4 had been physically abused, you know, 1 in 5 had been sexually abused, on and on, the things that are traumatic and stressful and impactful on our health is not something that's limited just to those communities that are really disadvantaged or challenged. You know, it's a great secret, and it's something we don't talk about because it ties to, you know, a lot of taboo subjects. And you know, and I think the hope is that, you know, sometimes these problems, that when you deal with them, they are the canary in the coal mine, and this will become more widely understood, and people will be more willing to seek help and talk, because even if you're an adult, it's far better to talk and process and do something about it as an adult than it is to just pretend it never happened because you're ashamed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, you're right about the general thing, and specifically, you know, kids, I think the most important thing, I think each state, you know, one of the things that Jim Sporleader will tell you as he travels the country talking to people about this is that you have to shape what's right for your community. Lincoln is a reflection of Walla Walla's culture and its community, and I think there's a version of that high school in every community. It's going to look a little different in each place. But I think, you know, the irony really is, the irony to me is that everyone understands that the gold standard is small classrooms, and very large high schools, and in many high schools, they don't have the resources for small classrooms. And these kids, in a lot of ways, one of the secrets about alternative high schools, if you have good teachers there, is you're actually getting the small classroom
right.
that everybody clamors for.
Yeah, and on that note, we have to say goodbye. James, we're out of time. Thanks for the film. Thanks for coming to Milwaukee. It was really
you're
an
welcome.
Important film.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. James Redford, Paper Tigers is the name of his documentary. It will be at the Milwaukee Film Festival again on October 4th and on October 7th. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this show and for his on-air production here in Milwaukee.